Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Good afternoon, everyone, from Florida Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the July 31st, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, we have a real treat again for all of you today. In just a few moments, my guest will be former NASA astronaut and four-time shuttle flyer, Jay Apt. And if you have ever wanted to ask an astronaut a question, then this is the day, this is the moment, and this is the guy you want to ask it to. So I encourage you to think up your questions for the astronaut. Get in line now. Give us a call, 321-768-1240 from anywhere you are. Local AT&T wireless customers can dial *1240, make a free phone call to the studio here, or send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, I spent this past week in Nashville at the AIAA Joint Propulsion Conference. Saw some pretty amazing things being considered for future jet engines for airplanes and rocket engines for spacecraft. It was an eventful week. On Monday night, we had a tornado warning sound in downtown Nashville, and the hotel had to be evacuated. I had to watch, I watched the storm come in from my window. I was on the 24th floor, had a great view of the storm coming in, actually caught a picture of some lightning, and basically thought the worst was over. And then suddenly the warning sounded. The manager came over the hotel intercom system and said, please come to the lobby and we'll take you from there. It took us down to the underground floor, the lowest level of the Nashville Convention Center, which is attached to the hotel. We hung out there for about 15 minutes, ran into Bob Dickman, the AIAA executive director, former space wing commander here, and well-known locally. We had a nice chat with him. It was quite an adventure, and then I went back upstairs, and it may have been that night. I'm losing track now. It may have been that Monday night, or it may have actually been Tuesday night, but in any case, I was flipping through the channels of the TV, and on one of the high-definition networks that they have to show off the high-def, was 2001 A Space Odyssey was playing, and that was followed by the sequel, 2010, The Year We Made Contact. And those movies actually repeated all night. So every time I kept waking up, I'd see these different scenes. And, you know, of course, 2001 is the classic. It's the filmmaker's film. It's what everybody watches, whether they like space or science fiction or not. 2010, not so much, but I do love both movies. They're both very well done, and I certainly enjoyed them both. And as I was watching them, drifting in and out of sleep, it occurred to me that I had not yet watched 2010 in this year, which, of course, is 2010. I remembered in the year 2001, of course, there was a lot of talk in the media, and especially in the space media, about what we saw in that first movie back then and talking about the things that had not yet come to pass in 2001. And so with that same mindset, I was kind of watching 2010, and, you know, the situation, you know, not much improved. Might not so go so far as to say bleak, but again, not so improved. Just to remind you, in the movie 2010, you still had the Soviet Union existing, and there is this giant ship called the Leonov that goes to Jupiter with some Americans on board. Their plan to unravel the mysteries of what was presented in the first movie. The ship is incredible. It appears to have some kind of plasma drive for propulsion. They don't really ever get into the details. Perhaps nuclear power, hard to say. The ship has a spinning section to create artificial gravity. There's an inflatable balloon that inflates at one point to act as a disposable heat shield when the Leonov is going to use Jupiter's atmosphere to aerobrake into orbit. And that was one of the very first media depictions of aerobraking in Hollywood, and it was very well done, very accurate. From the chatter and the rest of the movie, we know that that in this space program, there are multiple space stations in orbit around and near Earth. Pan Am is still flying commercial trips into Earth orbit from the surface. There are various governments relying, obviously, strongly on the military use of satellites, with laser weaponry available, apparently. In fact, there's some chatter in the background that talks about when a U.S. warship sinks a Soviet ship, the Russians respond by destroying one of our military satellites. So a lot going on, a lot of capability there, some good, some bad. But I'm laying there and watching all of this and thinking, you know, of course, you know, this isn't the political future we want. But when you look at the space infrastructure, when you look at the technology that's showcased in the movie, you know, which all of it is very possible and very doable, you know, I can't help but do get a little frustrated, you know, exasperated, maybe even angry that we're not as far along as we could be. Now, there are folks out there, let me make sure I say this, that, you know, many in NASA management, a lot in public affairs, you know, who cringe whenever someone compares what they see in a movie with what's happening in real life, you know, and I get that. You know, I cringe too when I hear someone sincerely think that they believe the shuttle still flies to the moon, you know, or that they think the people at NASA are basically a bunch of idiots because, you know, they don't even have warp drive yet, which of course is on TV every day. What's the problem with the shuttle here stuck in Earth orbit? Well, you know, if you do look at these two movies, 2001 and 2010, you know, I think they have all of the pieces of a space program that I think we ought to have. You know, they showcase an infrastructure of space hardware that makes it possible for humans to go anywhere in the solar system that they choose to go, almost any time they want to go there. You know, and the whole thing seems to have a nice mix of commercial and government-run operations. So I think our space program needs, you know, and I'll use this word on purpose, a routine way to get into and out of Earth orbit. We need space stations in Earth orbit. We need multiple stations, not just one that can do everything. We need a station to host science operations, another one to deal with space tourism and the hotel and all that. We need one acting as a true spaceport, like an airport on the ground, where ships can arrive and depart and transfer people and cargo. These other ships that are coming and going, you know, they might have missions to visit the other planets. They might have missions to go to an asteroid. They might be smaller shuttles. They might be robot pods, like we saw in 2001, maybe to go work on satellites and refueling. You know, refueling satellites is a big deal. I mean, you know, do you have any idea how many perfectly good multi-million-dollar satellites in orbit right now that are useless because they have run out of steering fuel? You know, you top off the tanks, those satellites could be back in business earning folks billions on the ground in revenue without having to build and launch a whole new, you know, multi-million-dollar spacecraft. Well, anyway, the point here is that I believe we need a space program that gives us the pieces we need to go where we want to go when we want to go there. You know, it is not a space program, I believe, that builds a specific rocket with a particular spacecraft to fly a narrowly defined mission to a single place. You know, destinations and deadlines, footprints and flagpoles, you know, that served us well in Apollo. But one of the lessons of Apollo should have been that maybe that's not a long-term way to do a viable space program. And I think in many cases we remain in that mindset today. You know, now part of the president's original budget that I was excited about was the part about spending money on technology research, flagship demonstration programs that would help us develop the kind of hardware that we needed to go do that. But in any case, as I watched 2010 and listened to the propulsion experts talk about what the future might hold, you know, I was encouraged by what we are capable of doing as soon as we decide to go do it. These guys know what they're talking about. They just need to be turned on to go do it. You know, as KSC Director Bob Cabana told the community earlier this week, you know, the future is bright. We're just not clear yet on how we're going to get there. Well, as the credits to 2010 rolled at the end of the movie, I laid there in Nashville thinking about all this stuff, and I felt like I was impatient. You know, it's time for Congress and the White House to show some leadership, make up their minds, and set us on the path that we're destined to follow. Well, there you go. When we return, we're going to talk to former astronaut Jay Abt. Today's show brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to WMMB.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And indeed, welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Our phone lines are open, 321-768-1240 for your phone calls. The email address is spacetalking@aol.com. Well, when I was a reporter, long time ago it seems, for both the Florida Today and Space.com, one of my favorite space shuttle astronauts was Jay Abt. And mostly it seemed because every time Jay flew, I wound up with some kind of unusual connection to his flight that that gave us a chance to make, a personal connection of some kind, whether it was an interview or something that happened during the flight that was interesting, or even in the processing of the vehicle beforehand. But in any case, you know, beyond all that, Jay is just one of those rare guys that that has the technical knowledge, the training, of your best scientists and engineers, and but also knows how to communicate with the general public and get that sense of wonder across, and in fact is willing to do that as well. By way of introduction, Jay is actually a physicist by training, earning a doctorate in physics from MIT in 1976 as part of a team from Harvard. He helped make temperature maps of Venus based on data from NASA's Pioneer Venus probe in 1980. He joined JPL to do some planetary work, and then a few years later wound up in Houston at the Johnson Space Center as a NASA flight controller working shuttle payloads. In 1985, he was selected as an astronaut and eventually flew four times, Atlantis in 91, Endeavour in 92 and 94, back Atlantis again to the space station in 1996, and left a year later and has stayed very busy since. And this introduction is now officially getting too long, so let's stop here and just say to Jay Abt, welcome, sir, to Space Talk.
Thank you very much, Jim. It's a pleasure to be on with somebody who's so knowledgeable about the space program and has had that knowledge for a long time and communicates it well with the public. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I appreciate it, and you and I go way back, and it's been a lot of fun. And tell me, where are you? You're up north somewhere. Where are you calling from today?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and on a beautiful Saturday afternoon, I'm out here looking at my pool and surrounded by a couple of computer screens, and delighted to be talking with you.
My pool's got a little rain on it right now. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get into it yet today. And, of course, football's coming up, and we don't want to talk about the Vikings and the Steelers. We'll steer clear of that today. But let's talk about you.
Well, as long as you don't talk about a minor league baseball team, we'll be okay.
That's good. Well, and of course, Pittsburgh, your adopted hometown, and let's start by talking about how you wound up doing what you're doing in your career. How did your vision turn to the heavens, and what inspired you and motivated you to do what you do?
Well, in, let's see, 1960, early 1960s, my dad took me outside, and we watched the Echo balloon go overhead, a huge balloon that was easily visible even from a city. Mm-hmm. And I said, wow, that's really neat. I want to be part of that, and started taking Saturday morning classes at the Buell Planetarium and Institute for Popular Science here. Of course, that was the time after Sputnik when there was a great deal of emphasis placed on what's now called STEM education. Mm-hmm. In this country. And I had a 4-inch reflecting telescope and used to take it outside on pretty cold winter nights and look at Saturn and Jupiter, and just felt that getting involved with the space program was one of the most exciting things that a person could do in my era. I became very active in model rocketry. In the early 1960s, the National Association of Rocketry was just starting out, and I remember joining them and seeing in their newsletter about their first few national championships. I joined around the time of the fourth one.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad and I drove down to the sixth one, which happened to be at NASA's Wallops Flight Facility. And I just thought the whole thing was really neat. Stayed involved with model rocketry and got involved with science. Stayed involved with that all through high school, even though in high school we didn't have especially good science teaching in school. the stuff at the planetarium was good, and read everything I could get my hands on, including a lot of science fiction.
And maybe there's the answer that I was looking for. You know, you flew model rockets, as you know I did as well growing up.
Sure.
And my experience with the rocketry always guided me toward the hardware side, toward the launch operations side. And so I wanted to go take the pretty pictures of the planets. But I didn't so much care about what was happening at the planets. I just wanted to get there and make it possible to get there. You really kind of went in a different direction and really got into the science and the planetary and the physics of it all. And was it because of that experience with the planetarium, do you think, that the school education didn't steer you correct?
Well, I think that in those days, there were lots of ways to get good science education. You know, the educational TV stations were doing that. Before science centers, the planetariums around the country were doing that. There were lots of books for kids that you could read. And, of course, technical hobbies like ham radio and model rocketry really helped folks get their hands dirty with this. And I took the first model rocket into space, and it's now residing in Vern Estes' collection.
Yeah, and you obviously got to know Vern pretty well. And I met him the one time, and this was one of my fun personal connections with you. Of course, as you know, when you had your first flight, Atlantis STS-37, a bunch of us model rocket fans, not only locally but I think even from across the country, all got together at a gentleman's house, very involved in the Delta program. Everyone who knows Moose out there. And we had a nice big party in your honor. Of course, you couldn't come, but we were there. Vern was there and talked fondly of you. And you really were kind of the superstar of the model rocket community. I think you still are in some ways.
Well, you know, it's interesting. On that flight, we had at least three of us who flew model rockets, Jerry Ross and Ken Cameron and I. And I think maybe Linda Godwin had flown some as well. I've kept up with Vern and his wonderful wife, Glida, and served on the National Association of Rocketry Board for a while. And I've been very involved with the Team America Rocketry Challenge. Mm-hmm. You can find out more about that if you go to rocketcontest.org, that the Aerospace Industries Association and the National Association of Rocketry put on. And this spring was actually the first time that I wasn't one of the two range safety officers on the ranges down there, and that's because I was down watching the last scheduled launch of Atlantis.
Oh, yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, of course, model rocketry, we've talked about it before. My buddy Pat McCarthy and the gang, we've talked about it, and it's really one of those hobbies that, you know, you can learn so much. It's not necessarily just about launch operations. There's some physics involved and construction and building and all that, but the idea of the safety, the teamwork, I mean, there's so much there in that hobby that I don't think people realize. I think people think they're shooting off bottle rockets. It's so much more than that, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, this Team America Rocket Challenge for middle schoolers and some high schoolers, and by the way, there's huge college scholarships for prizes that the Aerospace Industry Association organizes, has some very good technology. These folks have a target. For example, in a typical year, it might be taking an egg to a particular altitude and then returning it by parachute, and you have to have a certain flight duration, and you've got points deducted for every foot that you're off the target altitude and every fraction of a second that you're off the target flight duration. And so, of course, that encourages people to learn statistical analysis so that they can launch quite a few of the same design and figure out what's going on and do regressions against all the affected parameters. And folks do extremely well in these things. And, of course, the altimeter is no longer the altitude is no longer computed by a guy with an optical telescope.
Yeah.
There's a real altimeter in the rocket that reads it to the nearest foot.
More and more amazing what they're stuffing into the nose cone. Let's move forward with about a minute or so here, Jay, before our first break with you, talk a little bit about that sense of exploration that you got when you were doing the Pioneer Venus work. It must have been a whole other kind of a feeling for you when you were there, part of that team.
Oh, it was tremendous. It was my first job out of my PhD program, and to be involved with a mission that was going to put a spacecraft in orbit around Venus and four probes into the quite unknown at that time atmosphere of Venus was just fantastic. I'd read a lot of books about the ages of exploration on this planet, and to be part of the golden age of exploration of the solar system was fantastic.
Well, that's great. And look, we're gonna take a break here. Jay, this is our 5-minute built and hold at the bottom of the hour here in our program. And when we come back, Jay, we're going to talk to you more about more of your straightforward astronaut questions and kind of relive the four flights and the highlights of because you had an amazing run there. In the meantime, if you anyone in the audience there has questions for Jay, this is a great time to ask an astronaut a question. 321-768-1240, the number to call. You can email, of course, spacetalking@AOL.com. And if you still want to stay in touch with what's going on with our show during the week, WMMBAM.com is the website that you want to check out. So we're going to take 5 minutes, news, weather, break, sports, all that stuff, back in just a few moments with Jay Abt. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. This is WMMB.
Be here for the heroes in orange jumpsuits.
Be here to feed your curiosity.
Be here for the goosebumps.
Major goosebumps.
Be here for the eye-opening.
Jaw-dropping. Excitement.
Of exploring space.
Be here for a day of fun.
And a lifetime of inspiration.
Be here at Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. Now through September 6th, Florida residents receive a free child admission with each paid adult. Restrictions apply. Download your coupon at kennedyspacecenter.com/Florida.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back, everyone, to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Brought to you by United Space Alliance, innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. 321-768-1240, the number to call into the studio. spacetalking@AOL.com is the email address. Our guest today, former NASA astronaut, four-time space shuttle flyer Jay Abt, one of the best in my book. And Jay, we have an email here from Jerry in Vieira. And basically wants to know, how safe is it to fly model rockets? And assuming they are safe, where can you get them?
Oh, it's extremely safe. In fact, I was the head of a committee a few years ago that was looking at safety. It's a periodic thing that the National Association of Rocketry does, and the high-powered rockets were the concern at that time. And there are lots of folks flying them. There's millions of them flown. The small kits by Quest or by Estes are readily available, I think even in Walmart, if I'm right.
I think you are.
Certainly on the Internet. The safety record is phenomenal. These are prepackaged, factory-made engines, so you're not fooling with the propellant. And that was the huge advance that was made in the late 1950s over the Homer Hickam-type rocket boys, mm-hmm. where you make your own propellant, and that was dangerous.
Oh, yeah,
but,
absolutely.
Glad Homer lived through it. But model rockets, as opposed to amateur rockets, you use factory-made propellants, and it's very safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, on the WMMBAM.com website, you go keyword space talk to our show page and look at the journal and scroll all the way down to the last one. In fact, you may have to go to two or three pages deep, but it's the very, very last one of all of those. Are a whole bunch of links to model rocket resources that you can use that we put up there when we did have Pat McCarthy and Wes Olszewski and the gang, and in fact, Tim Van Milligan from Apogee. All Avion, all college buddies of mine from Embry-Riddle, we're in the hobby, and we put that list together. So, again, if anyone's interested in model rocketry and wants to pursue it, there's a good resource there for you to check out. Well, Jay, talking about your astronaut career, you were in JPL. You're a physicist. You're studying the planets. And did you get the bug to fly at that point and thought you better head to Houston? How'd that happen?
Oh, I had been a pilot since I was a junior in college and had always been interested in aviation. It wasn't until the 1978 astronaut class was selected that I realized that you didn't have to be a military test pilot any longer.
Right.
And so I applied in 1980 and got an interview but wasn't selected. And all along about 1982, I called up the fellow who was the head of the selection board and said, well, what could I do to improve my chances, and why didn't y'all select me? And he said, basically, well, we weren't sure that you were operationally oriented enough, thought you might be one of these pointy-headed scientist types. Why don't you come over here to the Johnson Space Center and work in the Mission Control Center, and we'll take a look at you. And so I kind of threw over my scientific career for a while, and I went over to Johnson Space Center and worked in the Mission Control Center and applied in 1984 and again got an interview but wasn't selected.
Yeah.
So in 85, when next selection rolled around, I figured, well, it's either three strikes and you're out or third time's the charm, and I was lucky enough to get in.
As so many astronauts who describe their experience, it's not always the first time. It takes multiple times. And, of course, in your case, it must have taken a couple of times to dull the pointy head before you were selected.
Right. I think in my class of 13, there were, I think, only two who had not been interviewed before.
Yeah. Yeah, perseverance is a big deal. So you get the experience, and, of course, you had to immediately, as we all did, live through Challenger and the aftermath. And part of the story in your first flight, of course, to release what was eventually called the Compton, the Gamma Ray Observatory, the second of the great telescopes, you were on standby to do a spacewalk. We had not had a spacewalk in post-Challenger that we knew about anyway. And so we were all kind of anxious for you guys to get outside. I went to Houston, watched training, and involved in the hardware and all that. And that was going to be a big deal. And yet you got to go out early.
We had trained for the first spacewalk in 5.5 years. We'd realized that it was going to be quite a mountain of spacewalks to climb to go put the space station together, and so we better get back into it. So we'd pushed management to do some flight tests of some gear to differentiate among a couple of designs, three designs really, of some gear and get some other data that space station design folks needed. And so we had the first planned EVA in 5.5 years, and it turned out that the day before we were going outside, the Gamma Ray Observatory had some of its robotic systems fail on the giant antenna that was supposed to send all the data back to the ground. And it was a little while before we realized that it failed, because that was all ground commanded. And when we did, the ground asked Linda to shake it a little bit on the end of the arm and see if that would free it, and that didn't work, and asked Steve Nagel to move the stack so that it would go alternately into freeze and thaw cycles, and that didn't help. And then they asked Jerry and I to get in our little cloth spaceships and go outside and see what we could do. They faxed us up a plan, which we knew wasn't going to work. It was hastily drawn up, and they just made some obvious errors that would have had a foot restraint in the middle of one of our stomachs, for example. And so Steve Nagel, who was a fantastic shuttle commander, said, we were in the airlock at the time, pre-breathing, he said, fellas, I'm going to tell them that you're on board with their plan. Now you go out there and do what you need to do.
Yeah.
And that was just one of the greatest calls of a shuttle commander in the program. And we did, and I carried a bunch of tools, and Jerry, who'd had a couple of spacewalks beforehand, got over underneath it and just explored what might be causing the problem, and saw it was kind of stuck on some of the multi-layer insulation. And he muscled up and pulled it loose with 35 to 50 pounds of force. And then we went around to the other side and used one of the wrenches that we had to crank it out the rest of the way, 135-degree deployment. And then the ground got out the defibrillators and got their hearts started again. And meanwhile, we did some of the work we were going to do the next day.
That's amazing. You know, I'm surprised it took that much force, because, of course, I remember it looked like he just basically just touched it and it popped right free.
Yeah, it looked that way on the low-resolution TV cameras, but he really muscled up and pulled it out. There had been a long bolt that had been put in backwards and had snagged the MLI, and they hadn't retested it.
I got to admit, my heart's already racing, because to realize the incredible, and some of this might be media, but, you know, the incredible amount of pressure we were all placing on ourselves, and, of course, the drama of a spacewalk, and of course, the honest risk involved in going outside, and the first time in so long, and are we ready to do this, and just all that kind of angst that went with it to go out there and just, and it just was so easy. You did the get ahead test tasks and went out again the next day and again made it look easy as you all seem to do all the time.
Well, that was part of what Jerry and I had discussed early on. Was we knew that everybody would be watching our first planned spacewalk in a while, and so we were going to keep it light. And yeah. You know, we trained enough that we knew exactly what we were doing. And the key was just keeping it light so that the folks on the ground wouldn't get all tense. And I think we succeeded in that pretty well.
You know, and then I think about it. I think it boded well for STS-49 when they did the Intelsat rescue and they put the three guys out there. And, of course, that was Dan Brandenstein working on a napkin or whatever it is you had up in orbit.
Actually, I think it was Rick Hebe's idea originally.
Was it really?
He was watching inside when Pierre threw it and... I guess it was mostly when Pierre was trying to catch the satellite.
Yeah, yeah.
And Rick kind of figured out that you could do it better with three folks.
That's amazing. So that was flight number one. Flight number two, a space lab mission. You were working orbiter systems on the overnight shift, and was that more of a marathon deal for you guys than the sprint?
Oh, no. I mean, it was just great for me because I got the chance to learn everything about the orbiter. Being the commander of the night shift, I had to know much more about the orbiter systems than I did on STS-37, and that was just a treat. Working with Hoot Gibson, who was just a fantastic teacher, and I was really honored that he gave me the command of the ship for 12 hours a day, and it was a whole lot of fun.
Yeah, that was neat. That, I don't know if you remember this, Jay, but that was the flight when you guys landed. KSC had worked with me, and I was out on the runway to do a special behind-the-scenes feature.
Oh, I remember very well.
Do you really? And the look on your face, moments after landing, you're crossing the bridge, we waved to each other, the smile on your face was worth the whole thing. I mean, that was a great moment.
Oh, it was just outstanding. It was really good.
Yeah, yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Well, and I was going to say, and they let me stick my head in the mid-deck, and it was really kind of neat to see.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I just kind of crawled up the steps and stuck my head in and saw someone's coffee still Velcroed to the side of the wall and all that, and or fluid loading, whatever. That was great. STS-59 Endeavor, the first radar mission, was a great test of that vehicle or that system. It worked great. But then I want to talk real quick with about a minute or so to go here, and we'll come back about your last flight to Atlantis, going to the space station. How different was that for you sitting there on the pad knowing that you were going to the station as opposed to just going into orbit? You got about 30 seconds. We can follow up later.
It was outstanding. The neatest thing was seeing Mir go overhead the night before launch and knowing we were going to be there in a few days. It was just terrific. Being able to point and say, we're going there.
Yeah. There was a destination involved, and I want to talk about your experiences with the Russians when we come back, and Jay will pause here now. We are going to take one last break here, come back with a few more minutes remaining with the astronaut Jay Abt, and we'll tell you about what he's up to as well. So hang out with us for just a couple more minutes, and we'll be back with more. This is Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
And welcome back with the final segment here on today's Space Talk brought to you by United Space Alliance. We're here with former NASA astronaut Jay Abt, a veteran of four space shuttle flights and a heck of a lot of great space experience on the ground and in orbit. And Jay, we do have a phone call for you today. Matthew, calling actually from Raleigh, North Carolina, has a question for you. Matthew, welcome to Space Talk.
Hi.
Hi, Matthew. Go ahead with your question. Mr. Abt is waiting.
While you're in space, what do you do in your free time?
Ah, Matthew, that's a great question. The best thing that we like to do was look out the window and take pictures of the Earth so we could share the experience with folks when we come back. We did that when we were supposed to be sleeping. We did that while we were eating. We did that while we were listening to the ground. Looking at the Earth is endlessly fascinating. This is a fantastic planet.
Matthew, you're interested in the space program, is my understanding. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Yeah? Do you want to be an astronaut when you grow up?
Yes.
Really?
Terrific.
Good. Well, work hard, study hard, and be really good at something, okay?
Okay.
Call back again. Okay, there goes Matthew. I heard Matthew might be calling. It's great that he did.
That's terrific.
Jay, let's talk about the quick experience at the Mir space station. Not bad for Russians and for all that effort they put up there. That was a pretty handy little outpost, wasn't it?
Oh, it was great. It was huge. Looking at it while you were docked from the orbiter was wonderful, because looking out the overhead windows, you felt like you were in a sunny day because you had all this white reflective stuff overhead. And then scooting over there and seeing the folks that you trained with on that side of the Arctic Ocean, just right close to you. And they had some really nice gear there. It was no fancier than it needed to be, but it all worked. And it was a great station operated by good people.
Now, when you were involved in that and doing your training, and I'm sure you went to Star City and did the whole nine yards.
Sure.
Where were you at that point in the whole cultural thing? One of the great lessons of Mir for NASA, of course, was this idea of sprint versus marathon. You know, every moment plan versus, you know, a list of things to do, and a whole different approach to the operations. Were you getting a sense of that yet? Had you had that sense already by the time you were up there? What was that like?
Sure. Well, you know, the Russians called the shuttle the Orgon, the hurricane, or the blizzard, when it came through, because, you know, we were all just geared up. We were following a flight plan that was programmed down to every 5 minutes and so forth, whereas they were more task-oriented. And just get this done today, and you know, we're not going to tell you exactly where the tools are and so forth. And of course, for long duration, long distance flights, even if we go to Mars with a ion propulsion drive, that only takes 3 weeks and so forth, and then get on Mars. That's the way it's going to have to be. We're going to have to do it with much less ground thinking about things, and much more the folks in space thinking about things, along with expert systems. One of the requirements for long-duration space flight is going to have to be more crew autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't afford to have this huge, very competent, but very expensive standing army of folks in mission control thinking for you. You're going to have expert systems with you, and just think through yourself.
Make the decisions in real time on your own without having to keep calling back all the time.
You bet.
Yeah, absolutely.
With 45-minute one-way light time, that's just not practical, and we ought to be using the International Space Station to learn how to do that.
That's an interesting idea, almost like thinking of turning off TDRS two-thirds of the time and see what they do up there.
You bet.
Yeah, interesting. So now you came back from the fourth flight. You brought Shannon Lucid back. By the way, when Atlantis rolled over, Jay, you don't know this, when Atlantis rolled over for that mission from the hangar to the vehicle assembly building, I and my mother and a little group of tourists that we had, we were right practically under the wing, got to watch that. And forever, STS-79 has been like their flight. They've got patches, they've got pictures, and everything. So yeah, I know you didn't know that. But
oh, that's great.
But again, it made that personalization. And, of course, that's something I've said a long time. When you personalize the shuttle program, when you personalize space flight program, you put someone up next to the rocket, they watch a launch, you almost have to convince them one person at a time, suddenly they get it, you know, and the support is there for the rest of their life, and it's an amazing, amazing thing. And I know that, and so you left, you did your four flights, it was time to move on, and talk about, just kind of big picture, where you're at today, and talk about your orbitexperience.com, your website.
Well, when I came back from the first mission, I realized that we really needed to share the experience of looking at the Earth from space. And so we put together a team to put out a book that came out in 1996 called Orbit, NASA Astronauts Photograph the Earth.
Right.
National Geographic ended up publishing it. And it sold quite well, about 600,000 copies. Of course, I didn't get any royalties being a government employee.
Sure.
And so when I left NASA, I grabbed the Orbit Experience domain name and have a bunch of the pictures up there. And I do occasionally give lectures and so forth, and companies will ask me to come and talk. But my day job is as a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. I have an appointment in the Tepper School of Business and the Department of Engineering and Public Policy. My research is in the electric power industry. Of course, I tell people that I'm generally the only one in the room who owes their life to fuel cells and solar panels. But it's a wonderful field, and I'm just delighted to be in a fantastic university. I've got great PhD students, 9 of them at the moment. And you work your tail off, you know, and nobody in the space program is any stranger to that.
Mm-hmm.
But gee whiz, just being at a university is fantastic.
That's great. Jay, we're running out of time here. We want to thank you so much for being on the air. You've been a good friend for many years, and I was glad to finally get you scheduled. And we'll talk again in the future, see where we're going with NASA, and maybe get your reaction another day.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm happy to talk with you at any time.
Great, Jay. Thanks a lot very much, and take care. Have a great rest of the season. And we'll say bye to Jay Apt, calling from Pittsburgh. By the way, next week on Space Talk, my guests are going to be this year's winners of the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Space Club Florida Committee. John Conway, Warren Lackey, and Tim Hanrahan are all going to be with me in the studio talking old times, new times, future times. It should be a great program. And then 2 weeks from today, on August 14th, former NASA Flight Director Wayne Hale will be on the show. It'll actually be his second appearance. Wayne just retired from NASA. In fact, yesterday was his last day, and he is going to be making, one of his first media appearances, if not his actual first one, on Space Talk, to talk about his career and his views on the future of NASA and our space program, and he's very anxious to do so as a non-NASA employee. I think he's got some interesting things to say and some big observations. Remind you again, the next launch from the Cape is an Atlas V with the military communications satellite. Launch still remains set for August 10th, and Shuttle Discovery remains targeted for launch on November 1st. Well, that's it for today. Thanks again for listening. Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance and is a production of Milo Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer. The Home Mortgage Law Show is next right here on WMMB. And by the way, I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Thanks for listening today. So long.